Good Wednesday. Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report here today. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On this week's Walnut Wednesday episode, Taylor Charleston will talk about walnut scale and how to confront the pest in orchards, including during the upcoming dormant season. I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional news right after this.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
According to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service latest California Crop Progress and Condition Report, average temperature lows for California ranged from 41 to 73 degrees in the mountains last week, 51 to 71 along the coast, 57 to 83 in the Central Valley, and 59 to 89 in the desert. Average temperature highs for the state range from 62 to 108 along the coast, 81 to 98 in the mountains, 94 to 109 in the desert, and 94 to 109 in the Central Valley. Stone fruit harvest, pruning, and topping continued last week. Peach, prune, nectarine, and plum harvest remained steady. Raisin grape development continued. Table grape harvest was well underway. Persimmons, kiwi fruits, Asian pears, grapefruits, and lemon sizing steadily increased. Old citrus groves were removed to make way for new plantings. Pomegranate maturation continued. Olive development was ongoing. Almond harvest continued. Weed and pest spraying continued where necessary. Walnut development was ongoing. Pistachio maturity was nearing harvest. And in the vegetable crops, Capay Valley harvest of organic vegetables continued. Harvest of tomatoes in Sutter County began. In Colusa, Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo counties, processing tomato harvest continued. In Stanislaus County, garlic continued to dry in the fields. Early variety tomatoes were harvested. In Tulare County, peppers, pumpkins, squash, and sweet corn continued to grow. Eggplant and serrano peppers continued to be harvested. Some local stands sold summer squash and tomatoes. And the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service released the Pacific Region Milk Production Report. July milk production in California was up 2.2% in the report. Milk production during July totaled 3.52 pounds, once again up 2.2% from July of 2021 and up 1.3% from June of 2022. The number of milk cows on farms in California was 1,723,000 head, up 4,000 from July of 2021 and up 1,000 from June of 2022. Production per cow in California averaged 2,040 pounds. That's up 40 pounds from July of 2021 and up 25 pounds from June of 2022. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is warning producers to be on the lookout for spotted lanternfly. It's not in California yet, and the department is working to keep it that way. Adult spotted lanternflies are an inch long and a half inch wide at rest. The forewing is gray with black spots of varying sizes on the wingtips, and they have black spots outlined in gray. Hind wings have a contrasting patch of red and black with a white band. The legs and head are black, and the abdomen is yellow with black bands. Early instars or immature ages are black with white spots. By the last immature stage, the fourth instar, they develop red patches in addition to the black color with white spots. This is the last immature stage before they mature into an adult. Both the immature insect and the adult are quite visually striking. Adults are especially so when they've been startled and exposed the bright red coloration on their hind wings. When an adult is at rest or on the trunk of a tree, their gray spotted color may actually cause them to blend in with their surroundings. Freshly laid egg masses appear as if coated with a white substance. As they age, the egg masses look as though they are coated with gray mud, which eventually takes on a dry, cracked appearance. Very old egg masses may look like rows of 30 to 40 brown seed-like structures aligned vertically in columns. Coated egg masses may look like weird spongy moth egg masses, an insect also spreading in the eastern United States and subject to quarantine by California. Iceberg romaine and romaine hearts have been impacted by the INSV virus and Fusarium, along with other viruses that have taken over the fields this past month through the Salinas Valley. These viruses are not allowing product to fully develop and in many cases causing growers to disc entire fields. Growers are working to put only the best product available in boxes and bring the best quality to the plant for processing, as crews have been working diligently in the fields to leave any affected product behind. For the lettuce fields designated for processing, sizing that are currently unaffected by the disease. There is some variation in core sizing and growth, where some cores are curved in the head of the lettuce, making it a bit difficult for crews to see as they remove what they can in a field. This means harvesting at an extremely slow pace to minimize the risk as much as possible. Growers are having to place additional inspection on lines to cull out any defects not removed in the field. Currently, the market is in demand and exceeds supply due to lighter supply industry-wide. They are anticipating a very unstable market situation to continue for the remainder of the Salinas season. Greenleaf is also starting to feel the effects of this situation, as well as available supplies getting shorter. Red leaf and butter lettuce may be affected as the industry works through the balance of the season, but currently quality issues are not as severe. INSV virus is a plant virus that is passed from field to field by insects. Fusarium is a soil-borne fungus which causes the lettuce heads to die from diseased roots. Some farmers were dumbfounded when they heard about the Food and Drug Administration's sudden and unexpected change in food safety requirements for the use of agricultural water before harvesting a crop. The original compliance date was January of 2022, but the FDA administration has delayed it. Because agricultural water can be a major pathway for pathogens, the Food Safety Modernization Act's Produce Ag Water Rule originally established microbial quality standards for agricultural water, including irrigation water. The FDA has clarified that the proposed rule only applies if the agricultural water contacts the harvestable portion of a crop. It does not apply to water applied during or after harvest. That water must still meet specific microbial standards. As part of this, FDA points out it is important to keep in mind that there may be other water use that requires microbial compliance, such as the water used to make up fertilizers or other crop treatments. The feedback that the FDA received on its original version was that these microbial standards, which included numerical criteria for pre-harvest microbial water quality, may be too complex for growers to understand, translate, and implement.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report continues now with Taylor Chalstrom in with this week's Walnut Wednesday Report.
Depressed walnut prices and higher input costs have put a premium on pest management decisions and increased the importance of dormant monitoring for scale pests in walnuts. UCIPM pest management guidelines advise growers and crop consultants to monitor scaffolds, limbs, branches, and prunings in the dormant period for San Jose scale, Italian pear scale, and most prominently for walnut scale and frosted scale. At high populations, walnut and frosted scales can reduce yields and quality and create issues with other plant pests, particularly Botryosphaeria. Emily Sims, former UCCE IPM advisor and current senior manager of technical field services for Sutera, went in depth into some of these more prominent scale pests in walnut and some of the dangers they can pose.
The two primary scale species that tend to rise to the level of requiring treatment are walnut scale and frosted scale. There are also San Jose scale, Italian pear scale, and European fruit lichenium that might be found in orchards. And often these are not typically to high enough levels to be of concern for treatment. It really is walnut scale and frosted scale that we tend to focus on. Walnut scale, San Jose scale, and Italian pear scale are what we call hard scales or armored scales. And the cover of these, the scale cover, is this kind of flattened shape, and it's actually separate from the insect body underneath. This is kind of important when we start talking about some monitoring approaches. With frosted scale and European fruit lichenium, these are what are called soft scales, kind of a different general category of the overall classification of scales. And in that case, it's a much more domed body, and the actual scale cover and body are all one kind of single unit. All of these scale pests feed with piercing, sucking mouth parts. So they pierce into the plant and suck out plant juices. This in turn is one of the chief concerns with a scale infestation, because these openings can create entry points for pathogens. Specifically of concern is Botryosphaeria. And so that's one of the chief dangers of having a scale infestation in the orchard. Soft scales actually produce honeydew because they feed on the phloem. So honeydew is that kind of sugary exudate that they will secrete as a byproduct of their feeding. The hard scales do not. So a bit of an additional consideration when you have soft scales is this honeydew production, which can then can facilitate the growth of sooty mold and potentially lead to sunburn, increased likelihood of sunburn in walnuts, which is a big issue. Typically low to moderate overall population levels, if we take out the Botryosphaeria concern, are not terribly damaging to the plant. But anytime you get a high enough population Botryosphaeria aside, it can cause some decline in plant health and dieback and things like that. So we do have to keep an eye on these different pests.
Out of the scale species that Sims listed, the walnut scale, of course, is the most detrimental to walnut trees. Sims said it looks more or less like a crusty barnacle on the tree and can be hard to see, and really the only type of scouting that growers and consultants have is visual.
We don't have like traps and lures necessarily for these, so we're out looking for visual signs of the actual population itself, and we can monitor the crawler stage to some degree, but really what is suggested is to get out during the dormant period when the populations are quite visible, you don't have a lot of foliage that you're dealing with, and doing your dormant scout and actually looking for any and all of these species. So we'll be looking for evidence of walnut scale. So these kind of small white sort of almost daisy shaped clusters of the scale cover. It's really important that as you're scouting these populations, that you're confirming that they are an active infestation, meaning that they're actually still alive. With the hard scales, that scale cover can stay attached to the plant surface long after the insect underneath is dead, either from parasitization or an earlier chemical treatment. And so I always suggest taking a small blade, the tip of your knife or fingernail, if you can, scraping off some of the scale covers. And looking beneath, walnut scale has a bright kind of yellow body underneath if it's still alive. And if you poke into that and it squishes, you know you've got a live one on your hand. If you take that scale cover off and the body beneath is a little darker and translucent and flecks off really easily, that means that particular organism is already dead. And so before you decide to do a treatment, as we know, 2022 is going to be another year of uncertainty with water availability of resources with supply chain. And certainly we only want to treat when we absolutely have to prevent economic damage. So make sure that those populations are alive. At the same time, treatment thresholds or decision to treat should also heavily rely on how much natural biological control you're observing in the orchard. There are some effective parasitoids that kind of when left to flourish and not destroyed by some of our other practices can provide some pretty good control of these populations. And you'll just look for what are quite obvious, they're exit holes in the scale cover. So you'll see a perforated hole in the scale cover. That's where the adult parasitoid has emerged. And if you see a significant level of parasitism, you may choose to just let the biological control flourish and not treat necessarily at this particular time. The UCIPM website has some great visual resources for what to look for with each of these species with the dormant monitoring form. I did briefly mention monitoring crawlers. That's something that's done later in season. The reason why you would want to monitor for crawlers is if you're actually going to do a crawler treatment. We do that. It's pretty rudimentary, double-sided sticky tape wrapped around the twig or branch near what looks like an active infestation. And then we can understand when the crawlers are emerging to time a potential crawler treatment or as evidence that an earlier treatment, a delayed dormant, was effective. So that's the other main scouting method or monitoring method.
Sims said that really for all of these species, particularly walnut and frosted scale, the delayed dormant period is the most ideal period of the season to treat from an operational and an efficacy standpoint.
You really just want to get out before shoot growth begins. And so you've got some flexibility. In addition, during that delayed dormant period, you don't have a lot of other spray operations that you might be juggling once you get a coddling moth treatment and things like that. And so while the crawler treatment can be effective, you've got to time that based on crawler emergence pretty tightly. The years that we were doing studies, The crawler emergence was widely variable year to year between, you know, mid-April all the way out to mid-May. And so, you know, you've also got other operations there. You also have a lot more foliage, so you're not going to get quite the coverage. So delayed dormant probably is the Cadillac timing. If you miss it or didn't realize you had a problem until you saw crawlers emerge, then the crawler treatment is viable also. UC actually has some pretty great treatment guidelines for these different species. Italian pear scale rarely requires an insecticide treatment on its own. It's typically associated with lichens. And if you can control the lichens with what's called a Bordeaux mixture, which is a combo copper sulfate, lime, and water, usually that scale population then reduces. So we're really talking about, you know, walnut scale, frosted scale, and maybe if you've got some Lacanium or San Jose scale. With the delayed dormant treatments. Again, UC has some pretty good treatment threshold guidelines. And in addition, former UC advisor Danny Lytle and I created a pretty neat visual decision tree for all of the species except Italian pear scale with regard to treatment decision support. And that's available on the sacvalleyorchards.com website. If you go to walnut and scroll down to insects and pests, there's a blog post that says walnut dormant monitoring and treatment decisions. And we've created a nice graphic, basically decision tree for treatment there. The primary kind of insecticides of choice are insect growth regulators, either buprofurthin, which is trade name is Centaur, or pyraproxifen, trade name is Seas. Those seem to do the best job having the least non-target impacts to those parasitoids because they are more specific and less broad spectrum. Our research that we did a few years ago, Bob Van Steenwyck and myself, showed that we can actually suppress populations for multiple seasons after a treatment. And so it might not be that an annual treatment is needed, which circles back to the importance of that dormant monitoring to confirm whether your infestation is active.
Looking more into the biological side of treatment, many often wonder whether some of the biological species present in an orchard can interact with all of the scale pests or just certain scale species, or even the harder soft-shelled ones. Sims said, it's a little bit of all of that.
So typically you're going to have, if you have overlap between one particular parasitoid species, it probably will overlap more in the hard scale kind of family area, and then you'll have some separate species for the soft scales. And in some cases, the species are highly specific just to one particular pest species. The ones that are highly specific can be very effective, but then when their food source runs out, they kind of dwindle also. So there are some other non-parasitoids, so like just the generalist predators, lacewing larvae, different things like that also can come in and help kind of clean things up in a more broadly general approach.
For scale pests specifically, they can often be hard to treat depending on the threshold.
It's really sometimes much easier to know when you need to, right? When I've got a problem, I need to. What's that line of, maybe I can hold off this year or this season? That's the little bit of art science nuance there, where certainly, you know, the university and research has these sometimes numeric guidelines, but, you know, you look to the PCA, you look to his or her, you know, experience, what they've learned year over year, block over block. And, you know, it's something that I don't think with scale that it can really blow up on you huge within a single year, but it's just that keep an eye on it over and over and over time. And then rely on your expertise. You know, how risk averse are you? How risk tolerant are you in terms of maybe incurring a little bit of damage? You know, again, unless the population is very high, in which case, you know, you need to treat just for plant health, take into consideration what your Botryosphaeria load or pressure is in the environment too. That's actually one of the keys in terms of that decision-making. If you've got moderate population of walnut scale with pretty decent parasitism and your bot's fairly under control in terms of inoculum resource, then maybe you skip it this year. If you're having a big bot problem, you're not getting a lot of parasitization, then maybe you go ahead and make that decision to treat this year.
As for the problem of scale pests in general in California and California walnuts, Sims said the problem isn't getting worse per se.
I think with a lot of our pests in general, because they're driven by heat units and things like that, those that might add a generation a year and have more reproductive capacity. I've not heard that we're getting an extra generation yet of any of these scale species. There's still two generations per year apparent. So that seems to be relatively stable for the time being. I think that growers are understanding how to control it. The materials are working well. I say that for now, because as we know, when you're limited to just a few materials, the possibility of resistance developing is certainly there. So I would really encourage also that consideration of rotating the chemistries. The two growth regulators that we have are very different modes of action. They're both growth regulators, but one inhibits chitin synthesis. The other is a juvenile hormone mimic. So throwing those in rotation year over year, or whenever, whichever year you need to use them, could also be advantageous. So I think there's some level of stability in general from what I've heard. But with walnut scale and frosted scale, and in the time that I've been sort of active in the industry, it seems like there's a multi-year cycle. It can just be not dormant necessarily, but certainly just kind of at the stable level. And then all of a sudden we'll have a couple of years where it peaks and it becomes a big topic of conversation again, and then it wanes again. And why that is maybe natural factors or operational factors of different insecticide use. And we'll have to see as we're getting away from the broad spectrums, like chlorpyrifos, that maybe were more detrimental to the parasitoids. Perhaps those populations will rebound and provide some good service going into the future.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, working together to advance the industry. Together, we can do more.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10%, and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack is promoting the just-signed Inflation Adjustment Act. He outlined the IRA's investment in rural America, which provides USDA with nearly $40 billion, including $20 billion for climate-smart agriculture.
First of all, it's going to go into existing programs that farmers are acutely aware of and understand and appreciate. $8.45 billion of increased funding for EQIP. Now, $3.25 billion of increased funding for the Conservation Stewardship Program, $1.4 billion of increased resources for the Agriculture Conservation Easement Program, $4.95 billion for the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, another $1 billion for conservation technical assistance, $300 million for conservation technical assistance focused on carbon sequestration, and additional resources for staffing at NRCS.
Beyond conservation, a bill includes funding for biofuels, rural electric cooperatives, and more.
The bill also provides $500 million to build out the biofuel blender infrastructure necessary to continue to increase the utilization of higher blend biofuels, and also provides additional tax credits to spur the sustainable aviation biofuel industry. There's a significant investment in rural electric cooperatives. The challenge there is to make sure that rural electric cooperatives have the resources to be able to convert to more renewable sources. This bill provides for $9.7 billion. This also provides additional support for the Renewable Energy for America program to essentially provide additional grants and loans to 41,500 farms and businesses. So a tremendous opportunity here. And it doesn't stop there. An additional $5 billion is going to be invested under the Inflation Reduction Act that allows us to continue to do a better job of managing our forests and reducing the risk of wildfire.
The White House says the Inflation Adjustment Act will lower health care and energy costs for rural Americans while addressing climate and lowering the deficit. And speaking of USDA, the Department of Agriculture this week has announced the details of a $300 million investment for a new organic transition initiative. Funded in part by the American Rescue Plan, the initiative will help to build new and better markets and income streams for farmers, according to USDA. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says they are expanding USDA support of organic farmers to help them with every step of their transition. The number of non-certified organic farms actively transitioning to organic production dropped by nearly 71% since 2008. Through the comprehensive support provided by this initiative, USDA hopes to reverse the trend, opening opportunities for new and beginning farmers and expanding direct consumer access to organic foods through increased production. The initiative will deliver wraparound technical assistance, including farmer-to-farmer mentoring, provide direct support through conservation financial assistance and additional crop insurance assistance, and support market development projects in targeted markets. Farm prices and farm equipment sales declined in the August Creighton University Rural Main Street Index. The overall index fell for the fifth straight month. August slumped to 44 from 46 in July. The index ranges between 0 and 100 with a reading of 50 representing growth neutral. The region's farmland price index for August declined to 60 from July's 66, marking a 23rd straight month that the index has moved above growth neutral. August's solid reading was the lowest index since February of 2021. The August farm equipment sales index sank to 45.9 from 56.5 in July. After 20 straight months of advancing above growth neutral, the index unexpectedly dropped below the threshold to its lowest level since November of 2020. Index organizer Ernie Goss says that farmers and bankers are bracing for escalating interest rates and falling farm commodity prices. However, bankers expect to record a 1.7% decline in farm loan delinquencies over the next 12 months. Officials from the U.S. Trade Representative's office have a busy schedule this week. Assistant United States Trade Representative for Central and South Asian Affairs, Christopher Wilson, and Assistant United States Trade Representative for Agricultural Affairs, Julie Callahan, started the week in New Delhi. The officials held consultations under the framework of the U.S.-India Trade Policy Forum. Those talks continue through today. Then Wilson will travel to Bangladesh for discussions on a range of bilateral trade issues tomorrow. Meanwhile, Ambassador Jamie White met with officials earlier this week from Mexico to follow up on the July U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Commission meeting. The travels this week follow last week's announcement that the U.S. and Taiwan reached a consensus on the negotiated mandate for the U.S.-Taiwan Initiative on 21st Century Trade. Negotiations are planned for later this fall. New data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows that U.S. adults ages 20 and older reported a 3% higher prevalence of obesity during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic. The study analyzed data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System from March 13th of 2020 to March 18th of 2021, compared to a pre-pandemic baseline period of January 1st, 2019 to March 12th of 2020. Four behaviors that can influence the risk of obesity: exercise, hours of sleep, alcohol use, and cigarette smoking were also examined to help explain the change in the adult obesity rate during the pandemic. Participation in exercise rose 4.4% over the period, and people slept 1.5% longer, both associated with reducing obesity. Meanwhile, the number of days in a period of a month in which alcohol was consumed was 2.7% higher, and cigarette smoking dropped by 4%. The decline in gas prices is entering its 10th straight week. Gasoline prices fell 5.1% in the last week to $3.86 a gallon on average. Diesel prices fell 6.3% to $4.97 a gallon on average. The national average gas price is down 51.3% from a month ago, but 72.2 cents higher than a year ago, according to Gas Buddies' Patrick DeHaan.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.